It's my great pleasure to introduce Christina Vogt, who is an associate professor at the University of Oslo, and a dear colleague, I must admit. She is the proud holder of two Bavarian state examinations, which in Germany has an important significance. She's also, she did her LLM in environmental law in Auckland, and has received her doctorate from the University of Oslo, where she wrote a dissertation on sustainable development and the World Trade Organization. And she has been, for the last 3 years, the chief negotiator for Norway on the Climate Red program. So those of you who follow climate change law, that's a key piece in the developing global regime. And so she was also on the forefront of this important policy development. Now she's returned full-time to academia and is going to talk to us about up in the air, aviation in the EU ETS and the question of sovereignty. And I'm looking forward to your presentation, Christina.
Thank you, Marcus. Thank you very much to you, Marcus, for inviting me here and to the Center of European Legal Studies for this kind invitation. It's a pleasure for me being here. I've never been to Cambridge before. It's the first time. And of course, all of you, first time to Cambridge. It's magnificent. It's spectacular. It's really a great experience. So thank you very much. I don't need to introduce myself. You just did that. Nothing more to say. I will talk about for about 35, 40 minutes. Marcus is going to indicate when it's about time to stop. But it should give us ample time to have some questions and discussions afterwards. However, if you have questions, if you would like to make a comment, if you would like to have some more clarifications, just interrupt me anytime you want to. It's okay. I'm happy to answer your questions anytime. Okay, what am I going to talk about today? Brief outline, I would like to say something about the factual link between aviation emissions and climate change. Then I would like us to have a look at the regulatory framework, both on the international level and on the EU level, dealing with aviation emissions, or emissions from air traffic. And then I would briefly like to dive into this tenor of international criticism that has been able to be heard from all sides and media. This is the Financial Times just from yesterday, an entire page on the EU ETS, EU emissions trading scheme, and the Chinese and US criticism to it, the entire page. So it's something that is really topical and it engages a lot of players. And then I would like to zoom in on the decision by the European Court of Justice from December last year, which I handed out here. Of course, it's a longer decision. It deals with a number of different aspects. And I would like just to zoom in this aspect of sovereignty, state sovereignty, territoriality, and the issue of extraterritoriality that was dealt with by the court. And finally, have a look at what's next, what is happening right now with this aviation thing in the EU ETS. Okay, well, let's start with this factual link between aviation and climate change. Well, aviation, or emissions from aviation, have a climate impact through the releases of greenhouse gases. It's not just CO2, but CO2 is the major component. There's nitrous oxide, water vapor, so it's a whole basket of greenhouse gases. But at the same time, aviation also emits soot particles and different particles that refer to as black carbon. So there's also a slight slightly cooling aspect to it. What I'm trying to say is that there is a certain extent of scientific uncertainty attached to the direct impact of aviation on climate change, but there's building up consensus that aviation has indeed an impact on the climate, and it's a warming impact. Well, in the EU, the emissions from greenhouse gas emissions from international aviation have increased drastically, as I said here, by 73% from 1990 to 2003, which equals an annual growth of 4.3%. Emissions from international aviation is one of the fastest growing emission sectors in the EU. And if this trend continues, then emissions from international flights, not just domestic, international flights, from EU airports or to EU airports will by this year have increased by 150% compared to 1990. So here we really see an enormous increase of emission. So although the share of aviation emission compared to overall greenhouse gas emissions in the EU is still modest, it's about 10%, it means that the growth in EU international emissions undermines the progress that has been made by the EU in other sectors in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. It undermines the progress, and it could offset more than 25% of the EU greenhouse gas reductions that are required by the EU target under the Kyoto Protocol. So, not good. Aviation emissions, well, the EU has, as you probably know, consistently confirmed its objective that rise in global mean temperatures is not supposed to stay below 2 degrees Celsius. And the EU pledged to reduce its emissions by 20 or possibly 30%, depending whether there's a comprehensive global agreement by 2020, is to be seen in the context of this overall objective. Now, on this basis, the Commission already in 2005 published a report or a communication which was titled Reducing the Climate Change Impact of Aviation, where it was stated that action needs to be taken to ensure that aviation does not undermine but contributes to achieving these objectives. And then interesting, the Commission continued stating that from an economic and environmental point of view, it's interesting that it has these both pillars, the inclusion of aviation in the EU emissions trading scheme is or seems to be the best way forward. So it is already a couple of years ago, and it took a while until it was then part of the EU legal framework. Now let's have a look at the international regulatory framework. We have, of course, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, the UNFCCC. And under the UNFCCC, only domestic aviation emissions are included in the national inventories of the parties. So not emissions from international aviation, but only domestic emissions. Emissions from international flights are dealt with what is called a memo item, which means that they should not be included in the national emission reports or totals, but should be reported separately. So there's a separate reporting on emissions from international aviation. But as a result, and that's important, as a result, emissions from international aviation are not subject to the quantified emission limitation and reduction obligations under the Kyoto Protocol. So Annex 1 parties, which have these requirements to reduce their emissions, are not required to reduce the emissions that stem come from international aviation. Now, the Kyoto Protocol in Article 2.2 very briefly talks about international aviation, and I included the text here, where it basically says that parties shall try to find a solution within or under the auspices of the International Civil Aviation Organization, ICAO. Whether this is an exclusive competence of the ICAO or not is something that has been discussed. Actually, in this case, and I dare to say that's not an exclusive competence, but at least there is this discussion going on both under the or within the climate regime, but also in the International Civil Aviation Organization. Now, the ICAO has not been able to take a decision on this issue. There have not been any concrete measures that have been suggested by the ICAO, no regulatory standards or on emission charges. Part of the problem that the ICAO has not been able to deal with aviation, international aviation emission, is a dispute between the developed and developing parties or members to the ICAO, because developing countries say, well, also within the ICAO, we need to find a decision which is based on the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities, which is defined in the climate regime, the Framework Convention and the Kyoto Protocol. Developed countries, on the other hand, say, well, ICAO is an international organization. In international law, the principle of equality, state equality, applies, so all states have to have the same equal obligations. And this is basically where it stands. So we have this one camp of countries saying, well, everyone has the same obligation. The other one saying, but we have to differentiate. And out of this, nothing really has happened. The ICAO has endorsed the possibility of participating in emissions trading schemes, but they have to be open, they have to be voluntary, and it's still not a binding decision or any recommendation. Now, in the latest, or the status quo of the fate of international aviation emissions in the climate regime is now the latest Conference of the Parties in Durban last year, where the parties simply agreed to continue their consideration of issues related to addressing emissions from international aviation. So we have a very unsatisfying picture internationally, both under the ICAO and under the climate treaties, because they sort of play the ball forth and back, and no action is really taken. Now, the EU, of course, was unhappy with the situation and amended the framework, the directive on emissions trading in 2008 by the inclusion of aviation. Now we have the directive 2008-101EC, which from the 1st of January this year now includes emissions from aviation. The amended directive has two objectives. Again, this is interesting, in particular from a WTO perspective, but we may come back to it. It has the objective to reduce climate change impact attributable to aviation in order to avoid distortion of competition. So there's this economic aspect to it, in order to create a level playing field. But also, of course, the objective to improve environmental effectiveness in a way to try to seek a way to address carbon leakage and to deal with emissions that are generated in areas outside the US, the EU as well. Now, this amended directive now covers all aircraft operators that either land in a European airport or take off from a European airport. And all aircraft operators have a cap on their emissions. This covers it's just below 3% below an annual range of emissions. Not so important right here, right now, but there's a cap on their emissions. And within this cap, single aircraft operators get allocated allowances. Now, 85% of the allowances will be allocated for free, and then the remaining 50% have to be purchased. So there will be auctions, and the aircraft operators can buy, as opposed to buy, allowances. Now, the allocation of allowances is based on ton kilometers, and this is actually where the problem starts in an international context. And I just need to use this flip chart here, although it may be very small, but I hope you can see it. Because ton kilometers is calculated in the following way. It's the sum of distance times payload. And it's the distance aspect that makes it so interesting.
Because it's the distance between the airport where an air the airline operator started from until the airport within the European Union. Or, if you want to say from the other side, from the European airport to the airport where the flight is going to. So if we have, for example, let's say that's the US and we have an airline starting from New York, flying to Europe, let's say to Paris, then the distance that is calculated into this ton kilometer is the entire distance between New York and Paris. At the same time, it means that all the emissions emitted on this flight, the entire distance, are calculated into this ton kilometers, covering the emissions that occur on the territory of the US. This is US territory, including 12 nautical miles. And of course, also in the airspace above the high seas. I'm sorry, that was a bit far. High seas. And then finally, EU territory. This is the case, France. And it's exactly the coverage of US territory or the high seas, third parties, that rose or gave rose to the international criticism. Of course, you can imagine if this flight is going to Beijing, then it covers the airspace of third countries and of Chinese airspace and so forth. But it's just important to remember that for the calculation, which basis is the basis for the allocation, emissions that occur in this part are taken into account, which is outside European airspace.
So each year the operators have to surrender a number of allowances equal to their actual emissions. If they have more allowances than they have emissions, then they can sell their allowances and, of course, have some profits from this transaction. And if they have fewer allowances and they actually have emissions, then there is a penalty of 100 euro per ton CO2 emitted. Now, if an aircraft operator fails to comply with this EU regulation, then the member state which transposes the directive can request the Commission to impose an operating ban. We'll come back to this issue. Now, this is a lot of text. You have it in front of you. It's really only to give you an idea about this outcry that happened internationally once the emissions trading scheme entered into force. India said it's discriminatory, it's a violation of international law. We think that EU's proposal is illegal because it seeks to charge airlines for the lag of the journey outside its airspace, the red part of the journey. This is an extraterritorial principle which is illegal and so forth. How can they dictate terms to us and why should we accept it? China, same tone. The EU initiative is an attack on other countries' sovereignty. We oppose any unilateral and mandatory moves that are taken without agreement of the involved parties. Actually, it led to the installment of a Chinese order of Airbuses because also China said, well, this is a violation of the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities, and they didn't want to buy the Airbuses anymore. Then in a funny alliance that we rarely see, these countries and some more actually said in a statement from last November, Russia, Japan, Australia, US, the inclusion of aviation in the EU scheme is a violation of the cardinal principle of state sovereignty. And the US continued. Hillary Clinton said also last December that if the US, if the scheme went ahead, then the US would respond with appropriate action. We haven't seen those actions yet, but there may be very interesting developments to have an eye on. Now, a number of American airlines challenged the validity of the measure transposing this directive into UK law. That was the Aviation Greenhouse Gas Emission Trading Regulation Act of 2009, UK law. And this case went to the High Court of England and Wales, and the High Court requested the European Court of Justice requested a preliminary ruling from the EU Court of Justice in 2010. Last year, last fall, the Advocate General, Juliane Kakot, she gave an legal opinion, which is very interesting to have a look at it, and I'll discuss it briefly. And then the final judgment that you have in front of you came in December, right before Christmas. Now the airlines, the American airlines, they contend that the directive, which includes aviation in the EU emissions trading scheme, is invalid because the EU infringed various international agreements, and this is the list of international agreements that they meant or claimed to be violated by the EU measure. Chicago Convention on International Civil Aviation, the Kyoto Protocol, and the Open Skies Agreement, bilateral agreement between the EU and the United States, and several principles of customary international law. Now, in my talk, I focus primarily on these principles. It's interesting also to look at the agreements, but I found it even more interesting to have a look at the aspect of or the role of customary law in customary international law. These are the principles that I claim violated. The principle that each state has complete and exclusive sovereignty over its airspace. Principle that no state validly purports to subject any parts of the high seas, you see the middle part there, to its sovereignty. The principle of freedom to fly over the high seas, which could be affected if emissions are taken into account there. And the principle that aircraft overflying the high seas are subject to the exclusive jurisdiction of the country in which they are registered. Well, as to the last principle, the court and the Advocate General hadn't heard of it, so they said that it's not existent. So we will look at the first three principles. In the request for the preliminary ruling, the High Court of Wales, England and Wales, raised two very basic questions. The first one concerns the circumstances in which principles of international law and provisions of international agreements, treaties, may be relied upon in the context of a reference for a preliminary ruling on the validity of a measure. So this concerns the direct effect of international law or the immediate applicability of international law. A very fundamental question that hasn't been dealt with, at least with respect to customary principles, hasn't been dealt with by the European Court of Justice before. And second, the validity of the directive in the light of international treaties and customary law, insofar as that directive extends the EU ETS to sections of flights that take place outside the airspace of member states of the EU. Again, as I said here, the red part, sections of flights that take place outside the airspace of the EU. Now, the Advocate General, she found this preliminary ruling very important. I included her statement here. She thought it was something that's of fundamental importance, not only for the future shaping of European climate change policy, but also generally to the relationship between European Union law and international law. In particular, it will be necessary to consider whether and to what extent individuals are entitled to rely in court on certain international agreements and principles of international law in order to defeat an act of the European Union. So it's actually something that has fundamental importance. It's not just dealing with climate emissions trading and so forth. Now, let's have a look what the Advocate General said on this requirement of direct effect. She said, in order for an international treaty or customary law to be a benchmark against which the validity of EU acts can be reviewed, of course, the EU must be bound. That's the first requirement. That was not so with the Chicago Convention. It was interesting to remind the court of that. Second, the nature and the broad logic of the agreement concerned must not preclude a review of validity. Here, the Kyoto Protocol sort of left the scene because the Kyoto Protocol Article 2.2 had a very broad and general content, and so it could not be reviewed. And third, the content of the provisions of the agreement must be unconditional and sufficiently precise so as to be capable, that's actually a continuation of the same requirement, so as to be capable of conferring rights to which an individual can invoke before the courts. In other words, they must affect the legal status of the individual, not just the status between states, but must affect the individual. And she continued to say that this applies both to international agreements and should also apply to customary principles. As I said, that wasn't decided, the court hadn't made any statement to the role of customary principles previously. But she also said that, although that also applies to principles, but principles such as those that were listed by the claimants are by their very nature and broad logic by no means capable of having an effect on the legal status of individuals. So in her opinion, principles cannot be used as a benchmark for review. Maybe different in humanitarian law, but these principles of state sovereignty didn't have the quality in her opinion. The court, however, had a slightly different take on this issue of direct effect of customary principles, because it asked whether the EU has the competence from the principle to adopt the act in question. And second, whether the act is A, liable to affect rights which the individual derives from EU law, or B, create obligations under EU law in this regard. I included the paragraph here, so if you want to read it, you find in paragraph 107. And this is in general possible for principles. There is a slight qualification where the court says for principles, judicial review is limited to the question whether in adopting the act, EU institutions made error or assessment concerning the conditions for applying the principles. So it's possible, according to the court, that customary principles of customary law can be used as benchmark for judicial review. Now, let's focus on the on the substance. Did the EU exceed the boundaries of state jurisdiction and thereby violated state sovereignty of other states, the US for example, or subjected parts of the high sea under its jurisdiction? Well, the claimants state that EU has created extraterritorial rules which contravene sovereignty of third states. The Advocate General, she said that the directive in question does not contain any extraterritorial provision because no concrete rule regarding the conduct of the airplanes or airline carriers is included in this directive. She says the fact, and that's important, that calculation of emission allowances is based on the entire flight, on the whole flight, does not bestow upon the directive any extraterritorial effect. There is similar, only account is taken of events that take place over the high seas and on the territory of third state. So account is taken of events as a part of the flight that happen outside European Union airspace, but it is not something that is extraterritorial. So that's what I highlighted here. Account is taken of is something that the court picked up and continued to elaborate upon. Though these circumstances, these events outside European airspace, may indirectly give rise to airlines or give an incentive to conduct themselves in a particular way, for example, use less fuel or emit less emissions, but it does not contain a concrete rule of how the airlines should conduct themselves outside European airspace. The court first asked the question whether the EU did have the competence under these principles to adopt the directive to the extent that it applies to the airspace outside the European Union. And the court said that EU legislation is applied to aircraft operators only when the aircraft is on the territory of the EU member states. Only when it lands or takes off an aircraft from the European Union, then does the EU legislation apply to an aircraft, to an airline operator. And because it only applies when it actually enters European territory, the act or the measure is subject to the unlimited territorial jurisdiction of the European Union. And on its own territory, of course, the European Union can self-define its level of protection. I included the paragraph here where the court says, as European Union policy on the environment seeks to ensure a high level of protection in accordance with Article 191, second paragraph, TFEU, the European Union legislator may choose to permit a commercial activity to be carried out on the territory of the EU only on condition that operators comply with the criteria that have been established by the EU. Sorry for this mistake. EU, and are designed to fulfill the environmental protection objectives which it has set for itself. So because it's a measure under territorial jurisdiction, the EU can itself decide which level of protection to apply. In particular, where the objectives follow from an international agreement to which the EU is a member, it's a party. For example, the UNFCCC, UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, or the Kyoto Protocol. And then the court continued, the fact that certain matters contributing to the pollution of the ESC or land territory of the member states originate in an event which occurs partly outside the territory, in the red part, is not such as to call in question the full applicability of EU law in that territory. So also the court said no extraterritorial jurisdiction by the EU. So it's important to note the distinction that has been taken both by the Advocate General and by the court, because it's a distinction between extraterritorial jurisdiction, which the directive is not, and a domestic measure with extraterritorial implications. That's something very different, because extraterritorial jurisdiction arises where a state assumes authority over actors and activities beyond its territories, beyond its boundaries. Domestic measures with extraterritorial implications is the case where the regulating state or the EU is able to rely on its territorial jurisdiction, but the regulation concerns the terms on which foreign parties may act or operate within that territory, but may have an extraterritorial implication. This is something that we find, or maybe find more of in the future, in so-called outward-looking environmental legislation. As we all know, the environment does not know any boundary, and environmental problems have a tendency to cross state boundaries. So states may want to discourage poor environmental behavior beyond their jurisdiction if that behavior has an effect on the state in question, or reduce transboundary environmental risk, create a level playing field. What I'm saying is that this is something that we actually may find more of in the future. Now, the question remains whether this link is still necessary between the area outside the territorial space, territorial airspace, and the territory of the regulating state. The Advocate General, she said, an adequate territorial, personal, or universal link is necessary. And she phrased it in this way. It is well known that air pollution knows no boundaries and that greenhouse gases contribute towards climate change worldwide, irrespective of where they are emitted. They can have effects on the environment and climate in every state and association of states, including the European Union. The court said something very similar, as I just explained in the previous slide. The court talked about the contribution to the pollution of the ESC or land territory of the member states. So both the Advocate General and the court still require an aspect of contribution or causation between the act in question and the territory of the state taking or making the regulation. there has to be some sort of link, some sort of nexus between the 4 minutes, yeah, between the act outside the territory and the territory of the regulating state. An interesting question which hasn't been answered, it's just something that I would like to put some emphasis on, is whether we may actually already see the contours of a universality principle in the field of environmental law. This principle gives states the right to assert jurisdiction over certain serious polluting activities. All nations in this case are regarded as having interest in preventing this pollution and also enforcing legislation. It's something that we find in international criminal law, those of you who study international criminal law, but it isn't really that prone and prominent in international environmental law. But since the both the court and the Advocate General are talking about having an impact worldwide affecting all states, it may indicate that it's not necessarily that there has to be a territorial link, it's just this universal aspect of climate change may actually talk for the acceptance of a universality principle because it's a global commons problem. Climate change is affecting everyone, everywhere. So what's next? Well, interesting enough, a couple of days ago, China has barred its airlines from participating in the EU ETS, which means that airlines cannot join the EU ETS without Chinese governmental approval. So the question that arises here is, well, what's happening now? Will the Commission impose an operating ban on Chinese airlines? That's going to be probably politically quite sensitive. But that, from the directive, is that the right way to do, the right consequence. China also considers a claim against the EU under the Kyoto Protocol because of the violation of the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities. Again, another very interesting question. Can this principle actually be invoked in a court? What's the content of the principle? Can a court review this principle? And which court? Where? So it's going to be interesting to watch this development. Also, the United States have reacted. The House of Representatives passed a European Union Emission Scheme Prohibition Act of 2011. This is the draft bill. European Union Emissions Trading Scheme Prohibition Act. Very interesting. Which would render it illegal for US airlines to participate in the EU ETS. A bit similar to the Chinese measure, though in the form of a draft bill. Well, this is probably a very discriminatory bill because discrimination happens on the basis of the citizenship of the airline operator or the country of registration. And it would actually violate the Chicago Convention, which this bill or the draft bill is meant to defend. So it's quite controversial, but it still has to pass through the Congress, and we hope it has a slightly broader view on the issue. India criticized the EU measure as a unilateral trade measure and considers a claim under the WTO because it says it's a discriminatory measure, it's a trade measure disguised as environmental protection. And as far as I know, India has sought a legal opinion on how to approach the WTO. I haven't seen a legal opinion yet. I don't know if you've seen it. Everyone wonders. But again, that's something that's in the air. It's under discussion. And it will be interesting to follow this development because it's not just legal, it's also legal, of course, but it's also a lot of political baggage attached to these discussions. India has also tried to take this issue into the negotiations, so far unsuccessfully in climate negotiations, but it's there as a thing that sort of rumbles in the back of it all. Now, this is as far as I wanted to come today, and I'm happy to take questions, answer questions, and I guess we have some minutes left.
Questions. If you briefly summarize the question for the audience online after they are asked.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, question. Yes, go ahead.
I just wanted to ask
on the relationship between international law and EU legal order on a more general level. Do you think that the requirement of direct effect, to have direct effect in order to be able to rely on international treaties as a benchmark to review the legality of EU law, do you think that's appropriate for a member state challenge? Secondly, what do you think about the ECJ's stance towards WTO law in light of EU law, and what do you think generally these developments say about the interplay between the EU legal order and international legal order?
Okay, that's a lot to summarise. First, it was the relevance of international law of a member in a member state claim,
yes,
right?
With direct effect.
With direct effect. I guess the same structure would apply there. Of course, the court dealt with individual claims or where it has a direct effect on the individual. But if it's a member state that brings a claim, I think the same legal environment applies there as well. I don't see any reason why we should differentiate the two. The second question.
What do you think about the ECJ's
WTO? Yeah, that's right. The ECJ's take on WTO compatibility. The ECJ didn't say anything about it. And I, so far as I understand the judgment, I couldn't even read something in between the lines. On discrimination or something. It just didn't take any stand on it. And it wasn't anything that the claimants stated. It was not on discrimination. Do you want to say something, Marcus? You see, like...
No.
Like
I've stated that it's going to be very, very challenging for anybody to challenge this measure in the WTO, because the question is there a violation of WTO law that
it's
we can actually find is going to be one of the key elements. And what is surprising, as we discussed last week, is that even though a whole host of countries announced consultations and launching disputes in Geneva and the World Trade Organization, none of these countries has come forward yet. There's a lot of uncertainty because these kind of decisions could go either way. And you can just imagine the political dynamite if the WTO ruled that this was actually perfectly legal for the EU to do. Imagine how many other countries would suddenly start doing exactly the same thing, and maybe in other areas as well. So a lot of countries are thinking that India is actually playing with fire when they are formally going to launch a dispute, because it's not entirely clear that the WTO dispute settlement body would actually find a violation in the first place. And even if they found a violation, there's a good chance, given the multilateral environment in which climate change negotiation happen, that maybe a justification might be found. That's probably one of the problems, but yeah.
This is just what you said.
No, it's interesting because India wants to launch a GATT claim on the basis that goods are transported by airplanes. But that's a very tenuous link, right? Because it's a claim twice removed from the good itself. You're transporting the good, which, in my view, is a service, and you're attaching the participation in this trading system to the service, not to the goods themselves. And that's so to say, this is a hindrance for goods in transit, or an additional charge for goods is going to be very challenging And then, you know, the question of what EU law would do with such a dispute settlement decision is then on a whole another level. And there we know more or less how the court would decide, right? We have enough case law on WTO dispute settlement decisions to know that the Court of Justice is probably going to ignore that kind of decision.
Yeah. Well, there's a slide I didn't include in the handouts because it would have meant it had another page. it's what Marcus just said. If it's a trade and service, then the GUTS has an annex on air transport services, which are included from the scope of the GUTS, basically. If it's a trade in goods, then as Marcus said, it's very removed from the measure itself. And where's the discrimination anyway? It's still very difficult to see. And even if it was a discriminatory treatment, then we still have the justification possibilities under Article 20. And the EU measure is flexible in the way that it takes account of measures in different countries if they are of the same character. So if another country has an emissions trading scheme or another climate measure, it may actually be excluded from the scope of the EU ETS and doesn't have to pay for the allowances. Multilateral negotiations have been going on in the ICAO, in the climate regime, so that there is no violation of the chapeau really that I can see, and I think Article 20 justification would be impossible.
Yes, a small point of clarification about how it works. If you have, say, a flight taking off from Sydney, stops at Dubai, outside the EU, and then goes on to the EU territory, do they calculate it from the last time it was on the ground in Dubai or from Sydney using some criteria to say that's one flight because somebody could book one ticket to cover it or something like that?
I think it depends on whether it's an Australian airline or not. If it's an Australian air carrier, then it's the entire flight, the entire leg between the between Sydney and the EU.
Lisa?
Yes, thank you for the presentation. I think it's very interesting. And I know it's very difficult to foresee this sort of thing, but how likely do you think that this is to go some way towards breaking the political deadlock at the ICAO level? So how likely do you think it is that it will, that this creates an incentive for the other states to try and agree to create a framework that applies globally to avoid this sort of regional initiative?
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting because when the European Union decided to establish that measure, they wanted to do it in order to to set up a global solution or to provide for a global solution. And what they actually succeeded with in the end was to unite almost the entire world against them. So that sort of backfired in a very bad way. And also in the ICAO, there is a meeting soon now, next week or in 2 weeks or something. It's very, very soon, where we already have heard voices by India and Russia that they would like to probably come up with yet another statement or something that is very, very strongly opposing the EU measure. So I think when it comes to finding a global solution, that was probably not the best way to do.
Yeah, I think we've exceeded our time. Thank you very much, Christina, for an engagement.